When I was a little kid, all I wanted to be was a scientist. I was fascinated by science, by the very idea of discovery. So my plan was to graduate from school and go to college and be trained to be a scientist. That plan did change, however. By the time I was in middle school, my plans and dreams for my life had changed quite a bit into something, frankly, a bit more realistic for me. I wanted to be a professional wrestler. I had dreams of wearing a Speedo in front of thousands of screaming fans every night. Just knew at age 12, 13, 14, that was my life. So kind of being the same as a scientist. This may come as a shock to you, but life did not turn out the way I had planned. Dan's doing it too. Okay. The fact is, I did not become a professional wrestler, mostly because I was tired of people telling 14-year-old me that I needed to start lifting weights so that I could be a pro wrestler. I mean, when I was 14, I was 5'4" and just full of 120 pounds and pure attitude. I didn't have much else. You know, there's an old Jewish proverb that says, man plans, but God laughs. Surely God laughed at little old me with my middle school dreams of pile driving Ric Flair and drop kicking the Road Warriors out of the ring. But what about real plans and real dreams? I mean, have you had hopes and dreams, plans for your life derailed in some way? Maybe you thought you'd have more money in the bank at this point and you could pay for the college tuition of an entire group of third graders, only to later be able to give them just laptop batteries. Worst episode of The Office ever. Maybe you thought you'd be married with kids or you'd be a world traveler, right? Posting YouTube videos of yourself traveling all over the world with, I don't know, your pet goldfish or something. But whatever your plans were or are, oftentimes they're derailed by either poor decisions or even by uncontrollable circumstances. And instead of all the great stories you had hoped you would find yourself with, you often find yourself with little more than what-if stories. Life, our plans frequently do not turn out the way we plan for them to. So here's a what-if. What if your life should not be about how God fits into your plans, but about how God fits you into his plans? And what if those plans that God intends for you to include you in are plans that cannot fail, that cannot be ripped away from you, that cannot be tripped up by circumstances or even by active opposition to them? What if God offers us a better plan for our lives, a plan only he could put together and pull off? Well, we're in Joshua chapter 8 this morning. We're looking at most of the chapter, so we begin in verse 1. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear and do not be dismayed. Take all the fighting men with you and arise, go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hand the king of Ai and his people and his city and his land. And you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king. Only its spoil and its livestock you shall take as plunder for yourselves. Lay an ambush against the city behind it." So Joshua and all the fighting men arose to go up to Ai, and Joshua chose 30,000 mighty men of valor and sent them out by night. And he commanded them, "Behold, you shall lie in ambush against the city behind it. Do not go very far from the city, but all of you remain ready. And I and all the people who are with me will approach the city. And when they come out against us just as before, we shall flee before them. And they will come out after us until we have drawn them away from the city. For they will say, 'They are fleeing from us just as before.' So we will flee before them. Then you shall rise up from the ambush and seize the city, for the Lord your God will give it into your hand. And as soon as you have taken the city, you shall set the city on fire. You shall do according to the word of the Lord. See, I have commanded you." So Joshua sent them out. And they went to the place of ambush and lay between Bethel and Ai to the west of Ai. But Joshua spent that night among the people. Joshua arose early in the morning and mustered the people and went up, he and the elders of Israel, before the people to Ai. And all the fighting men who were with him went up and drew near before the city and encamped on the north side of Ai with a ravine between them and Ai. He took about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai to the west of the city. So they stationed the forces, the main encampment that was north of the city and its rear guard west of the city. But Joshua spent that night in the valley. And as soon as the king of Ai saw this, he and all his people, the men of the city, hurried and went out early to the appointed place toward the Arabah to meet Israel in battle. But he did not know that there was an ambush against them behind the city. And Joshua and all Israel pretended to be beaten before them and fled in the direction of the wilderness. So all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them. And as they pursued Joshua, they were drawn away from the city. Not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who did not go out after Israel. They left the city open and pursued Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Stretch out the javelin that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand." And Joshua stretched out the javelin that was in his hand toward the city. And the men in the ambush rose quickly out of their place. And as soon as he had stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city and captured it. And they hurried to set the city on fire. So when the men of Ai looked back, behold, the smoke of the city went up to heaven. And they had no power to flee this way or that. For the people who fled to the wilderness turned back against the pursuers. And when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had captured the city and that the smoke of the city went up, then they turned back and struck the men of Ai. And the others came out from the city against them. So they were in the midst of Israel, some on this side and some on that side. And Israel struck them down until there was left none that survived or escaped. But the king of Ai they took alive and brought him near to Joshua. When Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the open wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them to the very last had fallen by the edge of the sword, all Israel returned to Ai and struck it down with the edge of the sword. And all who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai. But Joshua did not draw back his hand with which he stretched out the javelin until he had devoted all the inhabitants of Ai to destruction. Only the livestock and the spoil of that city Israel took as their plunder, according to the word of the Lord that he commanded Joshua. So Joshua burned Ai and made it forever a heap of ruins as it is to this day. And he hanged the king of Ai on a tree until evening. And at sunset, Joshua commanded, and they took his body down from the tree and threw it at the entrance of the gate of the city and raised over it a great heap of stones, which stands there to this day. After the people of Israel dealt with the sin of Achan, God is ready to move forward with them. The threat was real. If they would not deal with Achan's sin, God would not remain among them, and they would continue to flee before their enemies. They responded to this warning, and now it is time for them to continue the conquest in victory. In verse 1, God tells Joshua once again to not fear, to not be dismayed. He's saying, don't be terrified at what is about to take place. He reminds them that he has already given them the city. And see, from God's perspective, success is guaranteed simply because he promised it. From Israel's perspective, however, success requires strategy and effort. Now, this time, they are free to take the spoil of war. They're free to take all the livestock and all the treasures in the city, including its stores of food. Remember, this is taking place shortly after the winter harvest. The storehouses in and near the city would be full of grain and whatnot, and they're free to take it all. The people, however, were to remain harem. That is, they could not engage with those who chose to remain Canaanites. So God tells them to lay an ambush against the city. And that's it. Those are his military instructions. This is a real military strategy. It's one that's widely attested throughout history. It's a kind of an obvious strategy. It's utilized frequently in ancient Near Eastern literature. At Jericho, if you remember, God gave them very detailed instructions, but none of them were military instructions. Here at Ai, he gives them military instructions, but with very little detail. See, it's up to Joshua to figure out the details, how best to lay an ambush and how to take the city. The success is guaranteed, but that doesn't mean that they can just dance in the fields outside of Ai and expect the same result they had at Jericho. Now, notice in verse 1 that God tells Joshua to take all the fighting men against Ai. See, the first time, Joshua only sent 3,000 men against the city. He followed bad advice and didn't send everyone. So God is insisting that the entire nation must work together to accomplish the task God has given them. So Joshua takes all the fighting men. He heads off to Ai. He then chooses 30,000 men to lay an ambush. He sends them out at night so that they won't be seen by those inside the city, inside the fortress. They won't be detected. But he tells them to remain close enough to the city so that they can see what's going on, but not so close that they're detected. Now notice in verse 5 that it says, Joshua says, the rest of them will approach the city, and just as they did before, the people of Ai will leave the protection of the fortress and come out after them. Now, how does Joshua know this? Why would they leave the protection of their big, strong walls? I mean, he's going against them with a much larger army this time, and yet he knows that they're going to come out of the protection of the walls. How does he know? Well, he knows because this is exactly what he would have done. In fact, it's actually what he did do. Right? When they took Jericho, the fighting men marched around the city, right? When he sent men to Ai, he didn't give them instructions, as we saw in the last chapter. He presumed that all they had to do was march, and the same thing that happened with Jericho would happen with Ai. I mean, if that's how God did it once, then surely that's how God's going to do it again, right? No. Joshua knows that the people of Ai are encouraged, however. They are emboldened to fight against the people of Israel. The truth is that Achan's sin is still having consequences. God is with Israel, right? He has not left them. Israel is no longer in danger from judgment, yet their task of taking the city of Ai is now much more difficult because Achan's sin resulted in Israel's initial defeat, and Israel's initial defeat has given courage to the Canaanites. See, at Jericho, it was clear that the conquest was going to be entirely one-sided with very little real resistance. Now, however, every army they're going to face will remember the initial victory of Ai against Israel, and they will be hoping to repeat Ai's initial victory and will be emboldened to fight harder. A victory for Israel is still guaranteed, but victory for Israel is going to come at a greater cost. In verse 5, Joshua says that the men of Ai come out of the city against them, right? And he says that when they do, they will flee or pretend to flee before them. And now his aim is to further embolden them, to appeal to their arrogance, to their pride. And once Joshua and his men lead the men of Ai away from the city, the ambush is to rise up and enter the city largely unhindered. They are to then burn the city. So early the next morning, Joshua gets up and he gets the people ready for battle, right? The main part of the army was on a hill on the north side. There's a ravine in between, and then the fortress of Ai is on the hill on the south side of the ravine. But he had taken 5,000 other men and set another ambush west of the city, in between Ai and the city of Bethel. It's likely that Ai is a fortress guarding Bethel. So Joshua's north of the city, a large ambush is south of the city, and a smaller ambush is west of the city. So that morning, the king of Ai gets up and he looks out and he sees that Israel has lined up for battle. And just as Joshua predicted, he takes the bait. In verse 14, it says that he and all his people, the men of the city, hurried and went out to the place of battle. I think we can all understand how foolish this was, right? The safest place for an army under siege is inside the castle, right? You don't come outside, you stay inside behind the thick walls. Sin is arrogant, isn't it? There's no logic to it, is there? Sin never makes sense. Sin sees what it wants and will cause that person to give up everything to get what it wants, even if what it wants will never be satisfying. It never makes sense. Well, the ruse works. When they see the Israelite army fleeing, we read in verse 10 that all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them. Verse 17 says, not a man was left in Ai or in Bethel who did not go out after Israel. The men of Ai are all in on this pursuit against Israel, and now they're joined by the men of Ai to form a bit bigger army. Notice how inclusive this chase is, right? Everyone from the city was invited to pursue them. This means that more than just men of fighting age are involved. Like teenagers who normally wouldn't be allowed in the army are there. Grandpas think that they can wave around whatever sort of weapon they could muster, maybe the broom or something. They're all in on this battle. Everyone is getting in on the act. remember that it was Achan's sin that resulted in their boldness. Given the depiction of the Canaanites' fear that we had earlier, it's likely that the much smaller Ai, prior to that initial victory, that they would have simply surrendered to Israel were it not for the foolishness of Achan and of Joshua in failing to seek the Lord before sending out just 3,000 men. So the ongoing consequences of Achan's sin is that every single person who is able to carry a weapon from both Ai and Bethel is engaged, not just in battle, they are engaged in cosmic rebellion against the God of Israel. Remember that the conquest of Canaan wasn't about God taking Israel's side in a conflict. It's about God asserting his will over a specific part of his world. All who will join him may do so, and all who will oppose him will not succeed. Verse 17 ends by declaring that in their bloodlust, the warriors of Ai left the city completely unguarded. Not a man remained inside it. They left the city wide open, such was their confidence. Such was their boldness. Of course, God knew this would be the outcome, didn't he? So when they were a sufficient distance away from the city, he tells Joshua to give what appears to have been some sort of prearranged signal. He raises his hand holding a javelin. And somehow this signal is relayed to the men behind the city, and they got up and quickly enter the unguarded city. Now, I want you to think of the similarity between the conquest of Jericho and the conquest of Ai. It's actually more similar than would appear on the surface. See, at Jericho, God simply caused the walls to be irrelevant, right? He caused them to collapse. But at Ai, God also caused the walls to be irrelevant because God emptied them of their power in the form of no defenders. Look, the truth is that sometimes God works supernaturally by causing walls to fall, while most of the time God works through means, that is, through people. Now, in this case, God uses the sin and arrogance of the king of Ai, along with the arrogance and stiff-necked rebellion of the people of Ai and of Bethel, to get them to leave their intact walls unguarded. The Israelite ambush simply walks, or actually they ran into Ai through the wide open front door. Listen, sin got played. We got to understand that's what's happening here. Sin got played. The people of Ai wanted a one-sided victory like they had last time, so God gave them a one-sided victory, only it wasn't the victory they were hoping for. God allowed them to indulge their sinful fantasies, and they were conquered because of it. Conquering the city was a foregone conclusion. It was as good as done the moment God promised he had given the city to Israel. But God used the sinful arrogance of the people to lead to their own downfall. Well, as soon as the ambush team is inside the fortress, they begin to burn it to the ground. Verse 20, we read that the men of Ai looked back and at the city, and behold, it was on fire. That word for behold could be translated, don't! That's not what we're hoping for. Remember what Rahab said to the spies back in chapter 2, right? The fear of the Lord had come over the Canaanites such that they melted away before the Israelites. They were weak in the knees. They couldn't stand. Achan's sin had removed much of that fear. And so God played them by using that lack of fear to bring about their paralysis on the battlefield. People of Ai find themselves surrounded. The ambush was south of them. The smaller ambush was west of them. And the main Israelite camp was north and now west or east of them. Remember that the people of the land, that is the Canaanites, were declared to be harem, right? That is, they were declared to be devoted to destruction, which means Israel was to have no further interaction with them as Canaanites. Here's what we need to remember. Destruction can include conversion. Rahab the Canaanite was devoted to destruction. Rahab the Canaanite remained devoted to destruction. Her destruction as a Canaanite involved her ceasing to be a Canaanite and becoming an Israelite, a worshiper of Yahweh, God of Israel. Caleb had been, was harem, right? He was the Kenizzite, one of the smaller tribes in the land of Canaan that was devoted to destruction. The old Caleb was indeed destroyed, but the new Caleb was now the official representative of the tribe of Judah as a member of one of the 12 spies. He had been one of Moses' most trusted aides. When the people of Ai and Bethel found themselves surrounded, what they should have done was surrender to the people of Israel, cast down their arms, renounce their idolatry, and all the men should have received circumcision. In this way, they would really and truly be destroyed, devoted to destruction, yet they also would have found life. Sin wants what it wants, however, regardless of the terrible cost for it. They refused to throw down their arms, and instead they insisted on fighting against the God of Israel. Now, we know that the outcome of the battle was never in doubt. In verse 22, we read that Israel struck them down until there was none left that survived or escaped. Now, let me point out again the nature of ancient Near Eastern warfare rhetoric. Battles were described in hyperbolic terms. We killed everyone. There were lots of survivors. Were not two incompatible statements in the mind of an ancient Near Eastern reader. We actually read this exact same statement in the pages of Joshua, right? In chapter 10, we're going to see this. When Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished striking them with a great blow until they were wiped out, and when the remnant that remained of them had entered into the fortified cities, then all the people returned safe to Joshua in the camp at Makkedah. Not a man, that is of those who were completely wiped out, not a man moved his tongue against any of the people of Israel. They were all wiped out, and the remnant, that is, and the survivors, ran away. Right? The hyperbole simply means that they were completely defeated. It was a one-sided, lopsided victory. The victory was total. They ended the opposition entirely. This is what verse 24 means in our text when it says they killed all the inhabitants in the wilderness, right? Verse 25 says that the total number of all who fell, both men and women, were 12,000. Now, let me be clear. Many people did die in this battle, but it wasn't 12,000. The only people who died were those who persisted in fighting against the people of Israel. Those who insisted on fighting until their dying breath were simply granted their final request. They were killed. Verse 26 says, Joshua then devoted all the inhabitants to destruction. Remember, Horem is what happens after the battle. If 12,000 people, all 12,000 from Ai and Bethel and from the surrounding villages, were actually literally killed, then who was devoted to destruction? We see the same rhetoric here. We killed them all, and here's how we treated all the survivors. So with the battle decided and all resistance ended, the king of Ai was captured and taken to Joshua. All the survivors were then devoted to destruction. That is, they were free to either leave the land or reject their identity as Canaanites and believe in the God of Israel. Either way, their identity as Canaanites had come to an end. They were no longer free to remain in the land in active opposition to God and his purposes. Then we see that God gives the spoil of the battle to Israel. Whatever gold and silver, jewelry, whatever swanky cloaks from Shinar, whatever bronze and iron they found, they are free to take for themselves. Whatever livestock was left, whatever grain stores they found, belonged to God, and God was giving it to his people. And here we see how sad the sin of Achan really is. We see that if he had just a little patience, 36 men would not have lost their lives. 36 women would not have lost their husbands. How many children lost their dads? Now, there's no record of how many Israelites were killed in this battle here in chapter 8. Yet how many did? All because the people of Ai and Bethel were emboldened by Achan's sin to fight against Israel. One more man loses his life. The king of Ai is hung from a tree until evening. Yet at sunset, in accordance with the law of Moses, his body was taken down and buried at the entrance to the now burned out city of Ai. By the way, Ai means ruin, the city of ruin. Like Achan, Israel raised over his body a pile of stones as a reminder of what happens to those who oppose God, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of country of origin. Being born a physical descendant of Abraham didn't protect Achan any more than not being caused the death of the king of Ai. You know, one thing I find really interesting here in the telling of this story is that of all the battles that are recorded in ancient Near Eastern literature, there is none as detailed as this one. What is more is that in all those other battle accounts, the leader of the army is explicitly declared to be the hero. Usually it was the king, right? Most often the battle is the personal victory of the king or the pharaoh who led it. God clearly used Joshua in this battle, yet the battle is not credited to Joshua. It's not that Joshua was victorious over the people. Remember, God told Joshua back in chapter 1, or verse 1, to not fear, to not be terrified of what he was about to experience. That's hardly a depiction of a brave and fierce leader. The text, however, emphasizes Israel's role in this battle. Right? Joshua was instructed to take all the fighting men with him. He didn't merely select men for the ambush team. He selected 30,000 mighty men of valor. These men are described as being obedient to the instructions given them, for they were not discovered, though they were hid near the city as they were told to be. And when it was clear the city was empty, they did just as they were told. In fact, the text says they ran to capture the city. They hurried to set it on fire. They were quick to obey. The main fighting force is also depicted as obeying the commands from the Lord. They pursued all those who resisted them. They ensured that God's victory was total by participating with him in the capture of the people and the king of Ai, and in devoting all the survivors to destruction. In verse 24, the narrator is clear that it was all Israel who did this, that it was all Israel who returned to Ai and captured it. The narrator was sure to remind the reader in verse 9 that Joshua spent that first night with all Israel, with all the people. Israel was unified in obeying the Lord. Look, the simple and very profound truth here is that there is no single person in all of Israel who could do this by himself. Well, I mean, God could. We see this at Jericho. Remember, Israel did nothing to cause those walls to fall down, right? There were no battering rams. There were no siege engines. There were no sappers tunneling under the walls so that they would collapse. They were prancing around in the field, and God caused the walls to fall down. Now, God chose to defeat Jericho in this way for a very specific reason. It was important for all Israel to understand that they could not take credit for any of the victories that were to come, no matter how involved they were in bringing about those victories. The victories belong to God and God alone, even when God brings about victory through people. Jericho was the first battle of many, and served to demonstrate to the people of God that God did not need them in order to accomplish his purposes. God could act all on his own, yet that is not how God chooses to function most of the time. Most of the time, God chooses to use people to bring about his purposes. And the truth is that a fractured and divided Israel will not be able to do the work God has given them to do. His people must be united together in faith and obedience to God. That's what's happening in this text. All Israel enters into battle, and all Israel carries out the battle plan, and all Israel shares in the plunder. This is because all Israel obeyed the Lord. Now, at initial glance, this text is about a great battle plan, right? I mean, it has military precision. It's a great plan incorporating both strategic placement of troops as well as a form of psychological warfare, right? Using the enemy's own mindset and his arrogance against him. It really is brilliant, right? The greatly outnumbered foe is tricked so that they would leave the security of the city walls, so that the entire army, such as that it is, ends up surrounded by the far greater numbers of Israel's army. It's a simple strategy that wasn't difficult to carry out. It's brilliant military strategy. All that is really required was for Israel to stay in line, to be obedient, to follow God's instructions to the letter. But I think our temptation is to often think of God as a distant military commander, one who offers up rules and instructions from afar and then just leaves us to the task. So long as we do what he told us to do, we get good cop, right? But if we mess up, well, bad cop shows up very quickly to rough us up a bit, right? And then we get back in line, and then he goes off and leaves us alone until we screw up again. Now, in that scenario, the best we could hope for is as much good cop as possible and as little bad cop as possible. But is that the right scenario? Does that actually describe what God has done? Well, the truth is that God's plan for this world is on a much grander scale than merely keeping you and me in line. So often we think of the Christian life as sin management. Avoid being like Achan, and then things won't go so bad, right? Just avoid the really bad stuff and you'll be all right. Do as little bad stuff as possible. Now listen, there is a strong warning against sin in the story of Achan, but that warning is not meant to be a summary of what the Christian life is. No, you and I should not be in Achan. But God's plan for this world is so much bigger than you and me avoiding sin. It isn't less than that. Okay, hear me. God's plan certainly includes you and me not sinning, but it is so much more. Listen, God's plan includes all of time and history and geography and nations and people. It extends far beyond this planet we inhabit and includes the entire universe. It is a plan that is so comprehensive that all we can do is marvel at its scope and even more, marvel that God wants to include us in it. That plan is for the complete renewal and restoration of all things. In this season of Advent, we look forward to the return of our Lord Jesus, but we do so by looking back at his first coming, right? The birth of Jesus in this world was the, that's for the kids, by the way, his birth was the beginning of the final battle that was won on Easter Sunday when Jesus walked out of his tomb in eternal victory. His birth was the turning point in this cosmic battle between God and all who oppose him. It signaled to the entire world that the only right thing to do is to throw down their arms and worship him, to join him in his plans for the world, to worship him in this way, to participate in his renewal of all things by being renewed themselves. The whole point of God giving the land of Canaan to Israel and calling Israel to be his people was to show the world what life was going to be like under the rule and reign of God on earth. His people were to be set apart from the world. They were to be righteous, which requires that they turn from sin and obey God. Even more, they were to show the world what God is actually like. They were to be united in their obedience to the Lord, working together in unity to accomplish his purposes. I think it's not hard for us to see what this means for us. You and I are the people of God. We are called to be his witnesses in this world. We are called to represent him by showing the world what he is like. We demonstrate to those around us what it looks like to live and serve King Jesus. We live under his present reign, knowing that the fullness of his reign is still coming. Jesus is coming again, and he's not coming like a baby meek and mild. He's coming again as the conquering king who reigns over all things. What does that look like? That's how we live now. This is the eternal plan of God in Christ. He came the first time to begin the process of cosmic restoration by dying for the sins of his people. He conquered sin and death by rising from the dead. He is coming again to complete the process of recreating this entire world, this entire universe. This new birth, this renewal of all things begins with us, which means God calls us to join him in his plan. And we join him by being united together and serving him and his people. We join God in his plan to make all things new in Christ by obeying him and by living for him. But this requires every single one of us. Like the people of Israel at Ai, we can't go about this on our own. We do not approach the work of God as individuals. We must all be committed to the task, serving as the Lord leads. See, when I saw Israel, they saw an enemy who could be defeated. By the way, that's true of us. The world sees us as an enemy who can be defeated. This was because of Achan's sin. It caused the people of Ai to not see the Lord among them. This is why it is important for us to deal with sin in our midst, for us to show the world that we truly confess Jesus is Lord by living for him. It is when the world sees that we actually believe Jesus is Lord that they will begin to pay attention to us. God's plan is for our lives to point others to him. Each one of us, therefore, is part of God's plan. We're not bystanders. None of us here is intended to be a bystander. You and I each have a significant part to play in God's plan for this world. Now, our lives may not be turning out the way we had planned, but that's probably a good thing for most of us. See, for most of us, our plans would result in our glory, our name, our reputation, our pleasure, our ease, our comfort. Look, whether you wanted to be a pro wrestler sweating in front of tens of thousands of fans every night, or something else designed to elevate you in the minds of others, listen, God's plan is better. His plan is for you and me to be a part of his church, his visible body on earth. God works in Trinity, in us and through us to accomplish his will. Listen, no matter what your circumstances are, Whether you're married or single or divorced or widowed, whether you're childless or a single parent, whether you're a victim or you've been abandoned, whether you're a recovering addict or you've lived a pretty clean life, whether life feels pretty good right now or you'd like a do-over, God's plan is for you to participate in his work. Look, when I was a kid dreaming of being a scientist, or later when I was dreaming of being a pro wrestler, not once did I dream that my mother would kick me out at age 15 and that I would end up homeless for a time. It never occurred to me that that was the path I was to take. Never dreamed of it. It took me some time to realize that even in the midst of my painful circumstances, God was calling me to participate in his plan. He was calling me to keep following him by faith, regardless of my circumstances. By doing this, my suffering and my pain would have meaning. Through it, I could better reflect the glory of God to those around me. Listen, whatever your plans are for your life, whatever my plans are for my life, our plans are for our lives, God's plan is better. It incorporates some of your plans, but God's plan for us is better. God uses our circumstances to cause us to grow deeper in faith and love for him. And this deeper faith results in greater obedience, and greater obedience results in more of him in this world. That's a far better plan. Let's make that our plan too.